Speakers. That's my cue. It quieted down real quickly. So we'll go ahead and start. The meeting's been properly noticed.
It has been.
And we will begin with the Pledge of Allegiance. Please join me.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Welcome, everybody, this morning. We'll start with recognitions and turn the time to Dr. Iser.
Good morning. We have several recognitions this morning, and towards the end, I'll talk to you about two important retirements that we have had and then introduce to you one of our newest employees. The Southern Nevada Health District Nurse Family Partnership team has received a Certificate of Achievement and Appreciation from the Nurse Family Partnership Coalition for the outstanding commitment to young mothers and willingness to participate in research that will benefit children and families enrolled in the Nurse Family Partnership program and other national home visiting programs. So I'd like people to come up as I call their name. The Nurse Family Partnership team consists of Margarita DeSantos, who is the Community Health Nurse Manager, Maria Teresa Johnson, Senior Community Health Nurse. A few Community Health Nurse case managers: Lourdes Bambilla, Deyanira Goss, Patricia Montavo, and Jesse Venny. And Community Health Nurse 2, Celeste Liston, and Stephanie Reformina, and Adelina Folks, Administrative Assistant 2. Ms. Johnson also received additional recognition from Mr. Thomas Jenkins, President and CEO of the Nurse Family Partnership National Service Office. And I guess I'll hand this to you for pictures. I'll read this to you. It's much the same thing as what you've heard. The Certificate of Achievement and Appreciation for participating in the Maternal and Infant Home Visiting Program Evaluation in honor of your outstanding commitment to young mothers and families and your willingness to participate in research that will benefit children and families enrolled in the Nurse Family Partnership Program and other national home visiting programs. And as an aside, Nurse Family Partnership is relatively new to the, it's relatively new in the United States, relatively new to the district, and is our evidence-based home visiting program. So why don't you step, actually I want all of you step in between us, and I'll give that to you to hold for pictures. So I'm very pleased to introduce to you, if you haven't met her before, Montana Garcia. And she is by far not our oldest employees. I mean, you can look and see that right here. But she is our longest serving employee. At the last meeting, we recognized employees who have been with the district for a quarter of a century. Today, we have an employee who started when We Are the World and Madonna's Like a Virgin were number one hits, when First Class Postage cost 22 cents and the Golden Girls debuted on NBC. That was in 1985. So our most senior employee at the district, 30 years as of January 9th, so you're right at 30 years and 12 days, more or less, Montana Garcia. She started working in the district in 1985 as a secretary and was the executive assistant to Dr. Raven Holt for many years. Montana moved to Human Resources in 2004, where she continues to serve the district as a Human Resources Analyst. And this tells me what to say, but I really want to say thank you. You know how closely you and I have worked together over the last year, year and a half, and I really appreciate all of your help. So thank you very much. So the two people that I didn't mention to you back in November when we talked about Mars Patricio, who himself has already left, one of them is Alice Costello, who, as you know very well, has been with the district for many years, and she retired right after the first of the years. And the second one is Jerry Boyd, who was our facility services manager, and both of them retired on January 2nd after many years with the district. While we are currently recruiting for Alice's replacement, and if I could ask Sean to step, there he is, to step up. Sean is our new facility superintendent, between us, superintendent, and he assumed his responsibilities just a couple of weeks ago. And I can't tell you how important this position and Sean will be to us. When I had the last tour of the building 2 weeks ago, Sean stepped up and said, I'll come in on my Saturday and help out. And he's coming in, for those of you who are coming in 2 days, he's coming in to help us tour the building as well. The important part of his position, however, will be the significant moves that we have made over the last couple of weeks and will be making over the next year into our new building. And so I can't tell you how pleased I am to have Sean on board. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for that. Again, that's usually one of my favorite parts of these meetings is the recognitions. And, you know, children and family are a large part of what we do here at the Health District. And those awards that were given out today are very important to us and hopefully express our appreciation for what's been done there. To put Montana's tenure in perspective, I graduated from high school in 1985. So she's been here a long time. Thank you for your service for a long period of time. 30 years is great. I hope to get there one day. All right, we will start with our public comment. First public comment dedicated to items on the agenda. That's okay. State your name, please.
I'm Lorraine Oliver, and I just wanted to say that Montana was unbelievable to me when I was here and I lost my mom.
Thank you. Anyone else? All right. We'll close public comment, and we'll move to adoption of the agenda for today. Do I have a motion?
So moved.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed? That motion carries. We'll move to the consent agenda. Any discussion or changes? I'll entertain a motion then.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. And any opposed? And that motion carries as well. Moving right along to Roman numeral number 4, public hearing action items. Subpart 1 is Memorandum 01-15, amending the language of the Southern Nevada Health District regulations governing the sanitation of used mattresses, bedding, and upholstered furniture. And who will be taking that?
Thank you.
Board of Health members, good morning. My name is Paul Klaus, I'm Environmental Health Manager. And I have with me Daniel LaRubio, who is the Environmental Health Engineer Supervisor, who will be presenting today the amendment to the regulation on used mattresses. We currently have a used mattress regulation we've had in place for a number of years. It's very large, very administratively complex, and difficult to enforce. And what we're bringing for you today is a regulation that is much shorter, much more succinct, allows for more options for industry to sanitize, disinfect, use mattresses. We do have a mandate under state law to regulate this particular industry, but we felt that moving back toward the language in the NAC, which allows for more options, and adding an administrative process that will quickly get facilities regulated, registered with us, and so that we can maintain a watchfulness over that. And I will turn it over to Mr. LaRubio. He did the majority of the work on this project. So,
good morning, members of the commission. The current used mattress regulations were approved by the Board of Health in 2007, requiring the use of dry heat sanitization only. This proved to be a hardship because, as one local company found out, it could cost over $100,000 to begin a dry heat operation. In April 2011, our staff brought an amendment to the Board of Health, which, after several meetings and workshops, would have been more friendly to the businesses in our community. The amendment included several methods to sanitize used mattresses and was business-friendly, like I said. Excuse me. This amendment was not approved by the Board of Health, and we were told to revise the amendment and bring it back to the Board of Health in 4 months. This never did happen based on a management decision not to go forward. The proposed amendment will allow for 6 methods of sterilization disinfection. Dry heat is still allowed, but the temperature required is reduced from 205 degrees Fahrenheit for 1 hour and 15 minutes to 125 degrees Fahrenheit for 1 hour and 15 minutes. This minimum temperature will kill bed bugs and can be achieved with a less powerful oven. The other methods are as follows, taking from the NAC: boiling the mattress for 1 hour, steam under pressure for 30 minutes, 2 applications of streaming steam for 1 hour, each at intervals between 6 and 24 hours, chemical sterilization disinfection using an U.S. EPA registered chemical that is safe for disinfecting mattresses. An alternate may be presented in the operations plan, but must be approved by SNHD. A variance is also allowed, but must be approved by the Board of Health. The fees are now reduced to a plan review fee of $175 and doesn't have to be repeated yearly if the operations plan does not change. Also, a biannual registration fee of $100 will be required instead of a health permit. Only for complaints will a $275 fee be charged for an inspection. The costly nature of a dry heat facility has limited the number of permitted facilities since the regulations were adopted in 2007. One facility in Southern California has had a letter of approval for reciprocity to sanitize and sell mattresses in Clark County. And then one facility was permitted in Clark County in January of this year as a sanitizer, and that's the only one locally that has a permit. And I'd like to bring that board. I bring this to the board now for comment.
Yes, Doug.
Are we going to do any type of inspection at the places that actually sell the used mattresses to make sure that they're selling mattresses that are compliant?
Only for complaints. We don't have enough staff to get out and inspect all the sellers. There's a very large number of companies that sell mattresses that are used.
And if I may, I'm not sure that the regulations permit this, but in my experience, it's mostly thrift stores, secondhand stores that sell a lot of these, and that would be an impossible task for us to be able to do that. Mm-hmm. When I moved to, I'm used to donating old beds, and when I moved to Nevada, I couldn't do that anymore.
Do you have more, Doug?
Yeah, question. I was here in 2007 when we debated that part of it, and that was when we had another outbreak of bed bugs that kind of brought that forward.
Right.
I haven't read anything recently. Have we kind of turned the corner on that, or it just seems I haven't really seen... No, not in the hotels either then. Okay. So I support this, and I do think we had to be a little bit more flexible for some of the businesses. I do have a concern, though, about the secondhand. I mean, or at least garage sales. So maybe those of us in local government should look at our ordinances to, I don't know how you prohibit it, but maybe we just prohibit it. but there should be some, there's a ton of places that have mattresses for sale, let alone secondhand. And I just think people should be aware. And maybe on our website we could have some more information, maybe reach out to the El Mundo and Asian Times and some of the other groups and have some kind of public awareness ads maybe done, placed with them. So that might just be something. So people... We can kind of at least keep that under control, and if that's the case.
Commissioner, we do have plans to put some information on the website regarding the need for sanitization and also for labeling the mattresses as used. Apparently, there are a few companies that are selling them as new, even though they're used.
Ah.
So we need to catch those, and we need our public to be understanding of what they're buying.
Is there a special number that they would call if they wanted to call in a complaint, or they?
We could put that in the.
That would be helpful because I know a lot of us do as elected email newsletters to our constituents and some things along those lines. And we could at least put. It's like when I put in if you want to complain about helicopter noise, here's some phone number to call. So maybe we could do that as well as for the mattresses. Just information is power in the long run. So okay, thank you.
Welcome,
Cynthia.
Does any of this cover anything like other soft goods, like couches and chairs and fold-out couches, those kind of things?
We're limiting this to used mattresses and bedding at this time. We found that trying to regulate upholstered furniture, for example, is a huge task, and we just cannot take that on. But we can look at mattresses and bedding.
But if they were in a bed, they could probably look at the mattress.
So my understanding is if there is a complaint, let's say for a swap meet that's selling used bedding, you would go and investigate?
Yes, with a fee charged to the owner.
To the swap meet or to the whoever's got the booth for the mattress?
It would be for the person who has the booth for the mattress. It's their responsibility.
Doug, did you have more?
When you mentioned thrift shops, it's just brought to mind a lot of what I've seen in thrift shops. You know, the mattresses show up at their donations from the general public.
Right.
And I understand you don't have the manpower to go look at all this, but could we at least send some type of informational guide out to some of these thrift stores to things that they need to keep an eye on when they're accepting these goods? Because otherwise, we've circumvented the whole process. Somebody just take and dump them off at a donation center and... We've circumvented the regulations then.
And I would say a significant number of those don't go back into resale. They simply discard them.
I've seen a lot of them that are there, and I, you know, they shouldn't go anywhere but garbage.
But absolutely, we can get that information out to the industry.
Also, we're suggesting that with this regulation, mattresses that are to be donated must be sanitized first. They are not to go out to the public with problems that would hurt the public. Just because they're going through a thrift store.
Yeah, but that's from a commercial operation that you're not going to be able to enforce anything on a general public to the
correct.
Right.
Yeah, right.
Chris.
I don't even know. Do we license thrift shops as businesses? Does anybody know?
We do. As far as the
I would think the cities and the county would.
I would think, but I have no idea. There may be a
business,
category.
There'd have to be a business.
Well, I'm sure
license.
The state does as because we have consignment shops, resale shops.
Some are for-profit, some are not-for-profit.
So sometimes what we're trying to do in business licenses, when the renewal comes up, here's additional notices that you have to do. So at least maybe there's an awareness piece that we could take a look at least as the government folks, to say, hey, by the way, you can't accept something that hasn't been sanitized or you have a responsibility, because then you've got a linkage between their business license and their activities potentially.
Right. Even our nonprofit thrift shop has to have a business license.
Okay, and we probably do then. I just have never... dealt with that part, but that might be another way to kind of close the loophole without becoming so invasive and time-consuming.
Right. And this regulation does give them a means for compliance without buying a $100,000
right.
oven.
Right.
Bob?
Are bed bug infestations something that the health district tracks?
As far as complaints on public accommodations, yes, we do. I don't have the numbers with me, but we could probably get that for you.
That was a couple of years ago.
On bed bug complaints.
We do. I've seen pictures of Paul's staff going out and with a black light and looking for bed bugs on complaints.
I'm just curious if there's been any look at changes in the volume and level of those complaints after the legislature did this in 2007.
That was our regulation in 2007. It's been in the state regulation for a number of years.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
We just updated it.
We could look at that to see if the number of complaints has, or track the number of complaints per year.
I think it's relatively stable, but as Mr. Noonan mentioned, it's out there. It's ubiquitous. It's every hotel has this issue.
Mm-hmm. And again, let's point out that it's not necessarily the hotel's fault. Some may be if they get a complaint and can't respond to it, but you can't control what people bring into your rooms.
Right. People bring in the bed bugs.
Yeah, more often than not.
Bill?
Just a question. What can you enlighten us on what outreach you've done about this regulation? Because I know I've had some calls from interested parties about it. Has there been any public hearings? Who has voiced pro and con on this regulation?
Well, we did workshops for this regulation amendment, and we didn't have much response. We did have a gentleman who came in regarding the nonprofit sector, and he was adamant about us not regulating nonprofits. He said that what he does in his business is that they inspect the mattresses that they get, looking for bed bugs or stains or anything that would be, you know, unsightly and unsanitary. If he sees any of that, he just rejects those mattresses. So he's basically inspecting them by sight only. He's not actually sanitizing. And he's the one who would really like us not to enforce this on nonprofits. But we just cannot do that. Everybody must sanitize mattresses before they resell them. That's what our conclusion was.
However, one of the reasons that we included in the regulation an alternative method approval was because of his testimony.
Mm-hmm.
So that if somebody can bring to us an alternate method that assures that clean sanitary mattresses marked used being sold to the public, that we can approve an alternate method. So that they don't necessarily have to follow one of the NAC requirements for sterilization, which is again one of the things that we took from Mr. Moss's testimony.
Right.
And I believe he is here. Yes.
Here. Further question: What do they do when they reject the mattress? Does it just go to somebody else to?
I believe they landfill it. Correct.
Yes. Can I answer that question?
Please.
No.
Would you come up to the microphone?
Come up to the microphone.
This conversation is about me. Thank you for your time, ladies and gentlemen.
Introduce yourself.
For the record, my name is William Moss. I'm the executive director of CCS. My address is 4151 North Pecos Road, suite number 207. I'm directly across the street from the food bank. I'm the largest furniture bank in the nation. We operate primarily for the services of the hotels. The quad recently did 4,000 sets of mattresses. There's no one, I don't care what side of the fence you're on, that can take that many mattresses. We did 2,000 sets in 14 days from start to finish. And the problem, no one, Goodwill and so on, will not take them. The one that we find from a hotel that is questionable, I'm going to use the name of a hotel, Tropicana, when they remodeled many years ago. Not one of those mattresses came to my facility because the facility itself had a reputation. When we take on a facility like we did Station Casinos last week, the Santa Fe Station, that had a decent reputation. We inspected every mattress before it went into my truck. We also inspect it when it come off the truck. If there's any hint, the whole truck goes off to the only licensed rebuilder in town, or we send them to California, which is the other person's license to take them, Gateway Mattress. We understand their license of reciprocity has expired and they have not renewed it. per my conversation with Dan. Right. So right now, in Nevada, there's only one place they can take mattresses, and that's the one that has the oven. And they spent hundreds of thousands of dollars, and my understanding, it took a year to get approval. Mm-hmm. What we've asked is understand the problem the hotels have. And you asked some questions, if I may. There's some handout of the other cities and the problems and the infestation based on public records. And I don't know if there's enough to go around, but I'm taking over this meeting, and I'm sorry.
The question is, what do you do with mattresses?
Okay. Yeah, what do you do with
the mattresses? Once we reject, I set off to rebuilders. I don't believe in the landfill. I believe in recycling, and I got involved in recycling in 1989. Our nonprofit status go back to 1977. But as a result, there's not been one, not one reported incident of a nonprofit providing or spreading bed bugs. In my industry, Goodwill, Salvage Army, Desert Industries, and the others won't take mattresses. So what does the hotel do? The problem is, there's got to be a place. Okay? There's got to be a solution. And I strongly believe the solution is somebody like ourselves. And we will put the oven in time, but we don't have a bank account as it's such as going down and getting a line of credit to spend the $50,000 or $60,000 or $30,000, whatever it is. But to do it right, it's going to cost me about $60,000 to do it. So if you incorporate this law, I would beg, and part of our presentation will be at least 6 months to a year to bring our operation, because it's so massive. I did 10,000 sets of mattresses last year alone. I'm scheduled to start on February 1st, 1,100 sets of mattresses. Where do I put them? Where does a hotel put them? And all of you are, I'm sure, environmental people. You're environmentally conscious. If they go to the landfill, gosh, that's not the answer. We are a legitimate answer to the problem. Lois, good morning. I recognize a couple of names here. But the gaming industry needs us. We liquidate for the hotels. And the other problem is, it was addressed a little earlier, and I will step away, is the fact that bed bugs are not just in the mattresses. They're in the drapes. They're in the drapery rods. Right. They're in the carpet. They're in the furniture. They're in the radios, the telephones, the remote controls. And if you pass this law, it's going to limit the ability of the hotels. And you mentioned, and if I may take exception to what you said, this law does not stop anybody from donating furniture or product that's been sanitized pre. There's no language in there that I find. And it says so in the impact on the back, but read the law. It's not there. So if I want to take mattresses from XYZ Hotel, somebody here represents Boyd Gaming. Can anybody? Boyd Gaming. We did TVs from Boyd Gaming. We did the Gold Coast from Gold Gaming. We do work for every single casino in this town. And I'm taking your time. It's not my area to take, but I'm very passionate. We need to control it. We want to control it. And there's not one complaint. I've been doing this since 2007, and I started in 2005, studying what to do. I get newsletters every day from Bill Clinton's office to S.R. Schwartz to Joe Biden's office at the White House being infested with bed bugs. They come from other places than mattresses. They're hitchhikers. And I can go into that, and I will.
So you take them. That's okay. You take them to rebuilders.
If I can.
If you can,
they're gone. Rebuilder. If I have any question.
And rebuilders, I'm assuming, breaks them down, takes out this
silver bedding.
Okay, and then, so you're really a recycler for the gaming industry, at least as a minimum, in the hotel motels.
I'm probably the largest mattress taker, and I got the biggest target on my back, ma'am.
Okay, so they then donate to you.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, they don't give you a profit. Then you make a profit off of?
I support my operation. My rent's $40,000 a month.
Okay.
And a good part of my income comes from these mattresses.
And so this regulation really opens up what we did in 07. So I'm trying to understand, are you opposed completely? Because it allows the flexibility of you to be able to.
Thank you for giving me this opportunity to speak freely. I was all buttonholed.
I know, I noticed you over here. I was watching.
5 minutes. Okay. The reality is, we favor the oven. I started to spend $400,000.
Can you speak into the microphone? We can't hear you
on
this
side. I'm so sorry. So Mr. Boyd over here needs him. I need him.
Wish I was Mr. Boyd.
Okay, but my point is, we favor the oven. I almost spent $400,000, but we found at one point you were talking about lowering the temperature to 165 degrees, but that would not work for me to spend $400,000 in building brick-walled ovens based upon the code that was being passed.
Correct.
The code requires the floor to be totally sealed, all the base floors to be sealed. It was too demanding, and we found it was too cost prohibitive, and Gilbert spent $100,000. Oh, he spent a year's rent while he was trying to get approval. That approval process made it so I couldn't go into that business. We want to go into that business, but I need time. I need, if you pass this law, our prayer, using the a legal term, but the minister will get to that in a second, our prayer would be to give us 6 months to a year or two to adapt to this new condition. Because we will put the oven in.
So the oven is still there, but we reduced the temperature. Yeah. But what you're saying is we did not reduce the footprint of what we expect to be constructed in order to put that into play. It sounds like my pizza oven, okay, which was an act of God to have to, with no disrespect, to have to put in. So maybe that's the problem, is to make sure that we're not over-constructing something.
We don't know the way the law is coded and stated today.
We'll give them time.
I can't even tell you what the label is going to look like. We assume it's going to look like the old law.
Right.
So why not keep the old law, lower the temperature on the ovens, maybe include these other methods, but the other methods are, frankly, I've looked at them. I contacted Dan, and I've asked Dan to send me a list of approved chemicals. And with all due respect, Dan wasn't able to because he felt it was endorsing someone else's product. So I went to the Department of Agriculture, and the Department of Agriculture Exchange Service in Nevada sent me a list of three items. Okay? And they're all like a residential property. And they're not built and designed, those chemicals, for an operation of my size. Yeah. We're doing 10,000 sets of mattresses. I'm the target. I'm the one that, with all due respect, Rob, I'm the guy that you're probably looking, not to hurt, but I'm the one that you probably want to control. But not one person out of my facilities ever complained of a bed bug, because we're so careful. And we don't just look at it. We roll the edges back. My people have been trained to look for any signs. And there's telltale signs.
Okay.
I think everyone in this room will admit that.
So the effective date of this, back to staff, is?
Upon your approval.
Okay. So what he's asking for is maybe a phase in?
So bear in mind that what our intent was with Mr. Moss, and that's okay, was that the main reason we put in the approval of
the
alternate method, which isn't in the state regulation, is to allow us to work with Mr. Moss and other people like Mr. Moss to be able to come up with be able to agree on a method of even if it's not a disinfection method, if it's an inspection method,
identification
that as he mentioned, and it's absolutely correct that they go through it with a
every
very fine tooth comb.
And we shampoo them, by the way, too.
Right. So all of this could be, in totality, evaluated as a method for alternate approval, which is the reason we even put it in there was because.
So that's 1316 is what you're speaking to. So you would allow him to be able to bring you a plan. And verify that plan. Mm-hmm. So this works to your benefit. I know you have a little fear factor there, but I do.
No idea.
The issue is if we don't adopt that, you don't have an alternative method, which then puts you at more risk from us as the regulatory body. So I think we're better off adopting it, letting you work on 1316 with staff. It sounds like they're very amenable to it. And that gets you out of the game of having to build something horrendous, if that's the case.
Ultimately, we have some plans. And I don't mean to be, I'm taking a lot of your time. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for being patient with a man of 71 years old. And
you're a spring
chicken.
My
wife is homesick today.
70's the new 50.
I hope so.
I just made that up, but it sounds good. Sounds very good.
We're not sure about that.
Right here. To commit to the ovens.
Dr. Nemec.
And we're prepared to commit to the ovens in 6 months. They will be in my facility. I'm sorry.
Doctor.
Question.
I'm sorry, sir.
I'm trying to understand this. So you're presently not in compliance with the regulations as written in 2007?
As written and enforced, not enforced today, but as written today, nonprofits are exempt. And nonprofits provide a great service to the community. Now, with all due respect to what this agenda says and the impact statement, this law does not make the hotels sanitize their mattresses. If I can talk about that, please.
But the regulations in 2007
allowed an exemption.
Nonprofits, is that correct?
Okay. Yes.
Okay. If I can, because I'm an expert. Okay? And
we
these gentlemen are
too.
But the current law makes the hotel, does not allow them to give, trade, barter, steal, whatever the language is, to anyone. They either have to put them in disposal or they can give them to an approved agency. Voila.
Right.
That's why I built my company around that code,
mm-hmm.
so
right.
we can provide that service to the hotel. So right now, if you do away with this code, Mr. Boyd, give me, I'm using you as an example, they could put the mattress in the back of their hotel, and the public could come along and take them. Now, I'm sure that Mr. Boyd Gaming would not do that, but the motel, XYZ motel down on Fremont Street,
good.
That's what they've done. I've got absolute proof. But they do that, and then the homeless people take them. Oh, they take them maybe to sell them for scrap metal. But you need to control the hotels as you've done. So by keeping the current law in place, lowering the temperature to where this people like us can maybe put the ovens in, but keeping the law in that restricts the hotels from disposing their mattresses willy-nilly. And again, I'm focusing on you. But that's the answer. Controlling the sanitation of the sofas and the overstuff, the drapes, the carpet, there's no controlling. And it's going to be the wild, wild west if we adopt this. I beg you to reconsider this, table for another month or so. You will wind up seeing, and if you table it for a few months, you'll see the improvement. I'll invite the agency down and let them inspect and what I've got to change to make it. I'll do what I need to do. But I need time. I sound like you want to say something, Tim.
You know, there are some other sanitation issues besides bed bugs. I would assume that there's mites or there's food stuff such as a salmonella growth on a mattress that we ought to be concerned
biological
about.
Biological stains.
Some of them you can see and some of them you may not see. If somebody urinated on a mattress, sometimes you'll see it,
sometimes you won't.
Sometimes you will not see it.
If you ever change diapers, you'll see it.
But there are times that you will not see it, and I think that, you know, we need to be concerned with that level of sanitation.
I agree with you, sir, but this particular law is directed at bed bugs.
No. I don't know that that's the case.
Not true.
Cynthia, do you have a question?
It certainly seems to be everybody's focus, but that's not the only purpose for sanitizing a mattress in my mind.
I just want to clarify. Okay, now, that's fine. No, actually, you're answering a lot of our questions, and that's wonderful.
I'm so happy to do that.
Okay, so your current method is a visual inspection by trained employees of yours.
Yes, ma'am.
Right.
And shampooing. We use a $500 carpet shampooer.
Okay.
It does a great job.
And what is your method of quality control? Does somebody recheck their work or?
Yes,
okay,
ma'am.
But currently, and this is what I think Chris was trying to say, currently you're not in compliance with a law that's already there.
I'm in compliance with a law that's currently enforced.
They were accepted.
No,
okay, so your method is currently accepted, and I think is that not what we're trying to do is allow your method to still be used?
Correct.
Nothing was required of him up to now.
Right. He was exempted.
But they weren't required, so I think that was in 07, and I can't remember now why we exempted nonprofits, but we did.
Right. We did.
And now we're putting nonprofits under but allowing them an alternative method,
mm-hmm.
which I think benefits you, but your issue is the timing of all of that. And that's something that we can talk about. I don't think that there's a problem with that. We could adopt it and then say you have 6 months to come into compliance,
right.
and then that way you're moving towards it without the fiscal impact in a negative way. So I think that might get us to where we might need to go. But
me.
Mr. Moss, Mr. Moss.
No problem. I'm sorry.
Hi.
Mr. Woodbury.
I'll give you two more minutes, if you would, to wrap up, and then we'll let the regulators speak.
I haven't even done my official presentation.
Oh, that's okay.
Okay. Just to mention, if I can, on a national basis, CERTA is promoting, if I may, I only have a few to hand out.
Oh.
If you, someone could help me. CERTA is promoting the beds from the hotels to be donated to charities. That's a larger. CERTA Mattress, on a national basis, is supporting donating the beds to charities. On a national basis, we're the one that's got them to do that, to control and do away with the problem. Yeah. Because landfills are filling up. North Las Vegas, I mean, out here in Apex, they got God. But in California, which is where I came from, landfills, they passed the law, AB 939, that they had to reduce the landfill by 25%. If they didn't, the cities had to pay a $10,000 fine. I'm very familiar because I'm from California. I was very involved in AB 939. But CERTA is just an example of how the industry itself is trying to do something to control the problem by donating them off to a charity. But if the charities are not able to take them, okay, but we are prepared to put the ovens in place at any time.
Right.
And okay, now you gave me my time. Thank you for that, Mr. Woodbury.
Thank you.
And I promise to return.
Okay. Thank you very much.
No, thank you for your time, ladies and gentlemen.
Would you guys like to speak to any of the things?
So,
that
just
been
to clarify, the way that we read the regulation, the way it's been written, the impact on Mr. Moss would be that he would need to apply for registration with us and have his alternate method approved, and that would be it. And obviously, with any new regulation, that sort of thing takes a little bit of time, so it's not going to be an automatic enforcement. We would consider him in compliance until we either approve or disapprove his method.
Okay, so the six, if I might, Mr. Chair, so the six-month issue you feel doesn't need to be dealt with because it, you still feel that upon passage and approval, he would then bring in his plan, right. You would certify his plan. Right. If there's anything else that needs to be worked out, you would take, could we at least have a review period or something that reports back to us? I just want to make sure. I trust you all, but I just think
I think
that would
be fine. If you want to put that effective date down the road a bit, that's completely acceptable to us.
I'm trying to figure out how to do the effective date correctly because you can make it effective upon passage approval, but maybe nonprofits have 6 months to come into compliance. And then that way, you've got that flexibility, but they're working towards it. I don't know. I throw that out there, Mr. Chair, as an idea.
Or Mr. Chair, maybe...
Second that as a motion.
Maybe you would agree to July 1st, which is 5 months and 1 week. And that gives a good time for...
A time certain.
That's, yeah, a time certain
the board,
that we would
I'm
stop.
Just throwing out an idea to try to...
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I feel like I need to kind of speak for the industry a little bit. I don't know Mr. Moss, but I'm aware of his operation. And, you know, I think it would be a disservice to the industry not to have some kind of an outlet like Mr. Moss provides. Because I know firsthand in our company, if we don't have something like that, those mattresses, chairs, sofas, and all the other things that are in our hotel rooms would be in the landfill. Mm-hmm. And that's certainly not what any of us want. So I think that's an alternative that is much better than filling up our landfill with all these items out of our hotel room. So I certainly support giving him the necessary time to be an outlet for us to keep us from having to use the landfill.
Right.
Chairman?
So I'll try a motion, Mr. Chair. I would make it effective passage and approval, which gets him 13.16, and give nonprofits 6 months to come into compliance, or July 1st to come into compliance. And if there's any problem, that staff would report back to us then.
Yes,
Chairman,
that sounds
good. The question
was
asked by the board earlier about the bed bug problem. I have a newspaper article I'd like to submit.
Go ahead.
Thank you.
We do have a motion then. Is there any further discussion?
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Since this is a public hearing, I know Mr. Moss spoke, but there may be other members of the public who may want to speak.
Right. Okay. Right. I'll go ahead and take that second if we have one, and then we'll open
I'll
it.
I'll second it.
Okay. We have a motion and a second. Do we have anyone else from the public wishing to speak? Any further discussion by the board?
I have one other question, and that is, how are we notifying all the nonprofits?
We can develop a list and send out notices. That would be.
There's a nonprofit CEO board that meets regularly, and it's chaired by Steve Chartrand from Goodwill. I think they might have a list for you to be able to work off of as well.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Okay, we'll vote on the motion. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? And that motion carries. Thank you for your participation.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, we will move on then to Roman numeral 5. Number 1, review and discuss the health district's longevity plan.
As you all recall, I believe Mr. Jones brought this up in October or November, but was unable to be here for November and asked that we postpone this item until he could be here in January. I understand that there is a previous history, and I think, Commissioner, you were part of that previous history, and so it was accepted that we bring this back in January. So I'll ask Ms. Oakley to come forward. And we do have a suggested outline of what we would propose to you. Ms. Oakley.
Well, what we have, and I think Jackie's going to put it up, is where we are currently with longevity. We have an executive plan, which we only have one employee that's currently on it of the executive team. And then the rest of us, because the most of the leadership team is fairly new. Annette Bradley would be the next person eligible the end of this year, and then it's another 3 or so years before anyone else becomes eligible. What that list basically shows is what we're currently paying for the one individual that is on the executive longevity plan versus what the regular staff receive under their longevity plan of $110 per year of service times the number of years of service. And I believe at this point we're just open to seeing what direction we want to go in. Is that correct, Dr. Eiser?
That's correct. We have talked about this in the management team, and you can do whatever you want. You could remove longevity completely from all of management, should you choose to do that. You could leave the one person who is currently eligible for the current longevity plan and exclude the rest, or have the rest go in at the $110 per year of years of service, which is what our union and union eligible people have. Or you could continue the current management plan if you want. So our suggestion to you, at least as a starting point for the discussion, if we may do that, is that all people who are currently hired retain, they were hired under the current longevity plan, and allow them to go forward under the current longevity plan, but any new managers hired would revert to the union and union eligible plan.
Question, Mr. Chair. The piece of this debate was we had given direction as a board back in 07 or 08 to cease longevity for executives because it's point five seven. On a management salary, that's a huge number, and we've been trying to get a handle on that in our own government. I'm not anti-longevity. I'd rather you be paid all the same if that's the case, and I'd rather. But are you telling me that the board's direction was ignored then for the last 6 years?
Of course, I wasn't here, but Ms. Wells went back, and there was no board direction. There was a discussion, but no board action was made.
That's what happened, essentially. I can remember discussing it 2 or 3 times, and then
because I know I took it out of Larry Sands' contract, so I that I do remember. So
there is one addendum to what we suggest, and that is that we want to look at the county and the cities on their management plans and come back to you within several months to 6 months, let's say, with a total management plan. And I believe at that point, then, we would certainly suggest that you eliminate longevity. And there are a variety of ways that the county and the cities do management plans. It could be a couple of days off extra after 5 years. There are a variety of things, and we want to look at that and bring that back to you. I think you recalled that when we had the discussion about the union contract, that I had mentioned that managers would be willing to give that up if union and union eligible people would be willing to give it up as well, but that didn't happen.
And that's a stick. I mean, SEIU is not, that's where we're going to arbitration in the county.
I know.
It's the percentage that is, it's so disparate. When you're making $80,000 or $90,000 a year and you got somebody else that's working right alongside you doing your duty and they're getting $110, it's wrong. And I can't believe now we're still having this conversation. But then we better be clearer this time around. I don't want to penalize even somebody in management. I felt very strongly and thought that we had given direction. So if Tim says we haven't, then my memory is different than Tim's and whatever it will be.
And we would like complete direction at this point.
Because we took it out of your contract this time. It's not in your contract.
Well, correct? I was asked if I was willing to give it up before I even came to interview, I believe, and of course I'm willing to give it up. Yeah,
that's
it is not in my contract.
We had that conversation with the previous directors, and so that's where there must have been a breakdown. It was Angris that did that part of it.
I think that there was clear intention to do what you said, but it just never got
just never
up.
Got done. You know, I know we got rid of it in the county for management. I don't know if we traded anything or not. I really don't. I suspect, I don't think we did. But for employees, this is the group that's paid the less. It's county, it's still 0.57 for all the employees, and that's what management got, and that's how it usually worked in unions. If the employees got it, then management got what they wanted, and so they're the same as far as the percentage. This group and teachers are the only ones that do it on a flat rate. It's like I might get $1,000 after 30 years in education. But so this is a little bit better on that part of it. So I don't know. I'd like to hear what other folks think. But I really don't. I think if your compensation is correct, then you don't really need the longevity versus those that are in the industry that you want to keep within the industry, and that was the intent of the longevity for the employees.
And if I may, I think that times have changed. You know, it's 7-8 years ago, people did stay with the district or with an employer, with the county or with the city or with Las Vegas for many, many, many years. There are still incentives to do that, including Nevada PERS. But I don't know that $110 per year after 7 years, which is what I believe the current contract,
the new contract,
the current union contract says, I don't know that that's enough of an incentive to keep people here.
You'll have to ask them.
Mr. Chair, is there a difference in PERS treatment for longevity pay? Is it just considered regular old compensation for PERS purposes?
I believe it is.
Yeah, it's outside of that.
Okay. So that's not a piece of the puzzle at all.
Anyone else? Mary Beth.
Well, I think the staff's proposal is very fair. I always feel like when you've entered into a contract and that's an expected long-term compensation, that's fair. But I think for new hires, I know, as Chris mentioned, we've been cutting longevity from all of our contracts in the county, and I know when I was doing some research on it, it's used very little around the country. I could only find a couple of cases where it's used anymore. So I guess I would offer up a motion with staff's recommendation.
Second.
Let's make it very clear.
Are you comfortable with, do you want me to kind of state it, or
state
are you
it, because I think since I thought it was done years back.
If I
and,
just,
and she's right. I don't want to punish somebody that came in on those
offices. Lois has a comment as well.
I just wanted to clarify what Mary Beth is saying is that we have a commitment to those who are already here, and that remains the same, that came under that type of contract. But for all new employees, it would not be there. And it's sort of where we're moving
all
now.
All new executive
in the city,
employees.
Executive
employees. The others have to negotiate their piece.
Yes, yes.
So I'd be happy to read this for you.
Please.
That the board directs the CHO to continue the current executive management longevity plan for current executive management only, pending the development and implementation of a comprehensive management compensation plan, period.
Okay, and so we've got a motion and a second to that effect. Is there any further discussion?
I would say add the language that, just to clarify, that it would not continue for any additional new hires.
So if I may, and I know Jackie's listening, all new management hires would fall. I'm sorry? All new executive management hires, and it's your choice here, would fall under the same agreement that we have negotiated with union and union eligible employees, or get no longevity whatsoever. I'll give that to your choice.
Let me comment on that if I could. I would say no longevity compensation. My hope and expectation would be that whatever salary is offered to executive management would be comprehensive enough to cover the proper compensation of that employee.
And you all have given me that authority for the hires that I do, is to negotiate salaries. So I'm happy with that. So the second part of that would be all new executive management hires would no longer receive any longevity pay.
Is the term executive management defined in your personnel rules as a group of certain employees? Is that defined?
Yes.
Is that clear?
Yes, it is.
It's in the personnel code that you have approved.
Okay, so
I would make that clarify that in the motion, that language.
And we have a second?
Second. Ms. Tarkini.
All right. We now have an amended motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Any opposed? And that motion carries.
And we will put that into the new personnel code.
Yes.
I'm just wondering if it might be appropriate to take the audit out of order, just because we have our auditor here with us.
Sure.
Should we move to that second or next? Memorandum 02-15, receive fiscal year 2014 audit report. Hi.
Hi, good morning. Sharon McCoy Huber, Financial Services Manager. excuse me. The audit is completed as of June 30th, 2014. As we stated, we've gotten an unmodified opinion from the auditors. We have two representatives here from the audit firm of PBTK, Mr. Tom Donahue and Maria Gamboa. We met for a couple hours with the Finance Committee in December and reviewed all the information. And at this time, I guess the Finance Committee would make a motion. And then if you have any questions, either staff can answer it or the auditors are here to answer anything.
All right. I'll turn it over to Bob if he has.
I would move that we accept the audit report.
Second.
We've got a motion and a second. Any further discussion?
There were a couple of items that needed fixing, correction. It seems like they have been repeated from previous audit reports. I think one was looking at how we booked the time spent on
grants.
I'm thinking of how are we going to prevent that from reoccurring?
Well, number one, we have an electronic timekeeping system currently. We updated our policy in March of 2014, which I'm going to continue to tweak as we move forward. This has been addressed, and the way that we are recording our time currently is acceptable by the auditors because they did review it, and so we're going to move forward aggressively. We're also looking at adding hourly timekeeping to our electronic system. I mean, we're moving forward and improving as we move forward.
And in the past, that was done as a paper and pencil kind
yes.
of process?
Yes, it was.
Right. And I think the issue in the past is that if I was on a grant for 20% and 80-10 for 80%, is that I always put 20% of my hours, the individual didn't keep track of that. That has changed, and they're keeping track now. It may be 22% one 2-week period. It may be 14% the next, and that's what we changed and incorporated the electronic timekeeping system to represent. And we will be continuing to tweak that. As I think you all know, we do want to go for an ERP, Enterprise Resource Management program, that will incorporate probably as good or better of a timekeeping program into that. Once we get to that point, I don't think that there'll be any issues. I don't believe there are any issues left now.
Tom, do you have a comment on that, or is that accurate?
Hi, Tom. Tom Donahue. I'm with Piercy Bowler, Taylor Kerr, and I would agree with Dr. Iser. We've looked at the policies and procedures and changes and things that have been implemented so far, and we feel that the district's on the right track, and this won't be an issue going forward.
Thank you. And if I may, you may comment that this is a much better audit report than what we received last year. I think the Finance Committee would agree with that, and all of you would, too.
And I second that as well. I think the district's made a lot of improvements in its internal controls, and we look forward to working with Ms. McCoy Huber and Andy Glass going forward. So I would agree.
Thank you.
Thank you, and we appreciate the strides that have been made there. So we do have a motion to accept the audit report in a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? And that motion carries.
Thank you.
All right, then we'll go back to room number 5, number 2, receive and discuss nursing services quarterly report.
So this is a new item on the agenda for you. At our retreat last October or so, you asked that we start to incorporate sort of updates on a monthly basis. So our plan going forward is to take one of our divisions every 4 months and give you a smaller update than what you got sort of force-fed at that retreat. That would have been our plan anyway, is to focus in on programs. And as we went through, Ms. Sorensen agreed to be the first, and she's going to review in general the MCAH programs. And at a subsequent meeting, when her turn comes around, it may be STDs, HIV, it may be tuberculosis, it may be other parts of nursing services. And then when Dr. Lockett comes around, we may do something on the laboratory, and the next time it might be on FEP, Public Health Emergency Preparedness, so that over the course of a year, we hope that you'll get a pretty good update and more thorough understanding of most or all of our programs. And I'll turn it over to Ms. Sorensen.
Good morning. We started with the MCH program because it's probably had the most controversy. And I just want to give you an update on what we have done with the program and what it looks like today. And I am continuing to tweak the program. You can see the major divisions are the Nurse Family Partnership, since we had this last discussion, we were awarded a Healthy Start grant, which is just shy of $3.9 million for the next 5 years. And that is going to significantly help us, and it has allowed us to make this program a little more financially strong and to move people around into those grant positions. And as a result of that, it's taken $500,000 off of 8010 money. So we're really excited about the concept of Healthy Start, and I think it's going to solve some of the other issues that we have talked about, and I'll talk about more of it as we go into it. Really, a lot of it will focus on Healthy Start, the new Healthy Start that is being promoted in the country. The refugee program, we're seeing approximately 60 refugees per month, and maybe anywhere between 10, 15, sometimes 20% of them have some sort of a communicable disease issue that requires follow-up, some of them multiple communicable diseases. We have healthy kids, and we have one advanced practice nurse pending approval of a second, and another community health nurse who works part-time in this program, and the other part of her position is funded by the state to provide Medicaid for people newly enrolled in Medicaid and how to use their benefits properly. And then the what's in our MCH program, where we had the most controversy right now, we have two nurses and a CPS liaison nurse. We also, if you note, I have a note at the bottom, the state has applied for us on our behalf, because they were the only ones who could apply, to increase our home visiting perspective. Approximately six staff, including another lead and admin staff. So we won't know about this for a while, but that will definitely allow us to increase the number of people that are providing home visiting, evidence-based home visiting programs in our community. Okay, and just very briefly, and I kind of went through this, in our Nurse Family Partnership Program right now, we have 143 participants. We're full, and what you just received, it's hot off the press, is our latest report on our evidence-based program and the benchmarks that we are trying to achieve. And if you look at how we compare against the national average, we're doing quite well with our program. As a result, we have been asked to participate in a lot of research at the national level. And the refugee program I spoke to you about, we are doing and continue to do more healthy kids exams. You know, the Affordable Health Care Act is a wonderful thing, but we still have, having a card is not guaranteeing access. We don't still have a lot of physicians in our community. And our nurses and our APNs can do, the APNs can do the physicals, our RNs can do healthy kids exams. So we are a physician extender in our community. We have one nurse who is a CPS liaison nurse, and that's with social services, and they are paying a great portion of her salary. And the two nurses that are still in the MCH program have gone and are trained as child care nurse consultants, work a lot with our daycare centers. They are still taking our lead referrals and some of the referrals that we are receiving from the hospitals. We did meet with UMC, who was our main referral source, and we have really cut back on what qualifies as a referral to public health. They have staff shortages, too, and they didn't really have time to sit down and evaluate all of their charts correctly, I would say, and we're just referring everybody to public health, and we were ending up having to do the triaging, and so we ended up with a lot of referrals that probably we shouldn't have gotten in the first place. So you'll notice our referrals have dropped, and it's really because we've asked for referrals that really should go to public health. And then Healthy Start will be our new evidence-based program with measurable benchmarks, of which there are 22, and I'll explain that in a little more detail. And as I said, the increased potential of the Nurse Family Partnership Program. Healthy Start is a new approach to providing MCH services in the community. We are part with about six other states of the new Healthy Start. They're calling it Healthy Start 3.0. And the emphasis, it's more virtual, and it's not about reinventing a lot of what already exists in our community. It's bringing it all together. The population served is vulnerable families who have high incidence, women and children and living in poverty, and families that have a high incidence of infant mortality. And in our communities, that would be our African-American population will be a big focus of that. The service delivery model of Healthy Start is really to do a community assessment, to then do a gap analysis, then implement with our community partners where the gaps exist, and then to evaluate our progress. So I didn't think I'd ever say this, but really it's not about throwing more money at something. It's using that money smarter. And it's really about taking a good look at what exists in our community. So the Healthy Start, we're the hub, and I have our new coordinator, Aisha. Do you want to stand up a second? She will be coordinating the program, and then Lorraine is one of our nurses, and Raven is also another nurse. We have two other staff that we've hired, who one is moving from Florida, and the other one is moving from another program in the district. And they will be forming the backbone for us of this approach that we're taking. So you really get all of these, you know, these are the services that we're expected to take a look at, from referrals to nutrition, breastfeeding, community-based organization involvement, interconception, education, reproductive life. It should say interconception, not interception. Although I guess you could look at it both ways, right?
I was wondering what that one was.
Okay, and what we've been asked to create is called a Community Action Network, and it's referred to as a CAN. And I gave you an article about collective impact, and I hope you take a little time to read that, because it's a very innovative way to approach social change in a community. And it's more about looking at what exists. We don't have to keep reinventing the wheel. We have excellent parenting programs in our community. We have breastfeeding coalitions. We have an immunization coalition. We have community-based organizations. And you bring all of these partners to the table. You sit down and you take a look at the benchmarks that we have been asked to achieve. And as a group, then you set your own agenda. Nevada Children's Institute for Policy and Change is going to be our evaluator, so we're working with UNLV. And they will then, this group takes a look at, all right, this is what we have, and this is where the gaps in services are. And then we work toward the same benchmarks, and you have everybody who's willing to commit long-term at the table. So your public health agency doesn't have to do everything. It's really the community, each taking a focus on it. One agency alone can never do all of this. It has to be the entire community that gets around this entire issue. The benchmarks that I spoke about, and I'm going to show you, I gave you the report card that just came out on Nevada. And if you take a look at Nurse Family Partnership and Healthy Start, they will address, when you're looking at that report card, some of the issues that we need to improve in our community. And these are two evidence-based practice approaches to trying to make changes in your community. This was released Tuesday by the Children's Alliance, and Nevada is not doing very well.
Okay.
And a plus means we have an improvement, and a minus means we're not doing very well at all. And I think it's important, if you go to the Children's Alliance, and there is a legislative book that is there as well, because there will be legislation around some of these issues. And the bench book that they have developed will address that if you wish to and choose to support some of the initiatives that will be put forward in the legislature to improve some of these benchmarks that need some improving significantly.
What's an example of a community that maybe has a positive report? Or do they find fault with everybody?
When the lady did the rollout, she told us she didn't want us to feel too bad because there are other communities that are really struggling as well. I think Minnesota is a very good example of a state that has done quite well. Massachusetts, some of the East Coast states have also done quite well. Yes.
This happens to be my history. I commend you for getting that grant. And I don't know, does anybody remember Bernie Feldman, who started the UMC's intensive care nursery here, who died recently?
Yes.
Bernie and I worked together in the 70s and 80s, and Nevada and New Mexico under the health district, had maternal and health, maternal and child health programs. And at that point in time, would you believe we in Hawaii had the lowest infant mortality rates in the United States? It faded, and we're delighted that you're getting back in it. But the program that you're describing here, parts of it, it's been expanded, and there's a lot more bureaucracy than we had to deal with.
Yes.
But to give you an example of what went on in my state, and Bernie's was identical here in Nevada. We started out with a neonatal death rate of over 30 per thousand. Infant mortality rate was up to about 35 to 40 per thousand in the 1970, and by 1980 it was down. The neonatal death rates had fallen to less than two, and then it's crept back up. By the mid-80s, so we're not back where we were, but I'm delighted that you've got that grant.
Thank you, Doctor.
Yeah.
Okay.
Bonnie, we have a question. The access to health care, do you know what she looked at in that component? Because I think people assume ACA has worked, but you still have undocumented
right.
that still don't have access. So maybe that's the number.
Actually, I believe that what I read in that report, the access issue, as far as having a pay source, it's down to 11% compared to 16 or 22%. So this is a snapshot in time, and I think we've made some improvements in those areas. The issue still, though, is finding a physician or being on a long waiting list right. to get into to see somebody.
So that's still the component. So if we get a school of medicine down here and the legislature helps fund that, perhaps that might assist with
absolutely.
That part of it.
Absolutely.
And
if
then I'm sorry.
I was going to say, if I can add to that specific issue, I met with CCMS just this week, and the big issue is really reimbursement. So
we are the lowest reimbursement.
We are very much at the lowest. Medicaid is at the lowest. And so groups of doctors, maybe you all can confirm this, are having significant difficulty bringing people in because the reimbursement is less and they have to work longer hours here.
UMC also has less rates. They get it from the state. The
That's
state
correct.
Was not reimbursing us as well. So we
That's
were
correct.
At the lowest rate. So that affected the hospital stay.
So that and then yeah. residency programs.
Residency
I know
programs.
You well know that
yeah.
too.
Yeah. So we've got a lot of work to do, but at least this gives us a place to start from again. Immunizations, I see that we went up a little bit.
No, well, we're actually going down.
We went back down. I was reading actually in here, it's 38.
The truth of the matter is, and, you know, when all of that came out, we tried to explain to some of the other, the state, that we really didn't go up. The other states went down during the recession. The rate didn't go up.
Our ranking
went up. And so, yes, we still have a lot of work to do in that area. But if you can see on our report that we gave you, families that participate in home visiting programs, our rates are 90%, which is the national average. So there is value to our involvement with very high-risk families.
Remind me what you coordinate with the school district. Is it back-to-school days for the kindergartners? Or remind me, because you have DTAP, which is your middle school also
right.
that has to be.
Yeah, we have some initiatives, and we work with now it's called Immunize Nevada, the state coalition, and the state funnels money to them, and then they have funneled money to us to try, and they will actually pay for some of our events related to it. That's the middle school DTAP.
Middle school DTAP, mm-hmm. Okay, because that's probably a population that we were missing more than the little ones.
We have actually, our school district does a very good job of not letting kids in school who aren't completely immunized. Our issue, and this survey is done on the kids in the first 36 months. So we really have a lot of work to do, and our focus at the district is working with our daycare centers. That is where we're getting the most bang for our buck.
But if you're a poverty person, you're not in a daycare center.
Yes.
So we got to not lose that population of individuals.
Right.
Does the district refer to you the families that they don't enroll?
Oh, yes. They're standing at our door, without a doubt.
Okay.
Yes.
So at least, and then do we track that back to make sure that they then get enrolled?
Yes, and we actually have a recall and reminder system in place for families, and we also have volunteers that work through the PIO office. It's called Hope. I can't think of the whole last name, but it's a group of individuals that Jorge coordinates, and they come in and they actually make physical phone calls and talk with families.
There's an organization that formed. It's a multicultural resource center that's on Maryland Parkway, and they speak or have access to probably 45 different languages that you might want to work with, because we tend to always think it's a Hispanic community, but the Asian community and the variety of individuals within that community is huge. And sometimes just not knowing what they have to do. Immigration is not just Latinos. And so
that's right.
That might be another group you might want to reach out to that they came to me and they want to do some more community-wide activities.
Absolutely. I'd love to find out who they are, and I'll make some contacts for sure.
Okay.
In some of these categories, it looks like, there's only 36 or 34 states. Is that because they aren't tracking, or is it because they just refuse to report, or why is... I don't know. Sexual health has 29th out of 34... 16th out of 36.
It's possible that there wasn't data available from some of those, from what you're saying.
Right.
But we're not doing
They're
good
They're in now. Denial.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I'm trying to figure out if,
They were intercepted.
Yeah. They were intercepted. That's good.
Yeah. All right. Thank you.
Okay. And remember, healthy families make healthy communities. All right. Thank you.
Thank you. As an addendum, we had hoped to have Dr. Shear here today. Dr. Shear is a pediatrician, board certified, who has been working on her MPH and is looking at the data for the non-evidence-based MCH program that you funded last year. Excuse me. So she has not completed her analysis, but she'll bring that back to you next month.
Thank you. And thank you, Bonnie. Okay, we are on to Roman number 5, number 4, review, discuss, outline clinics.
So we're trying to become as flexible and transparent of an organization as we can related to all of our outlying clinics. We've discussed in the past that the North Las Vegas Clinic, for example, we are subsidizing with $8,010 significantly. And so we have had discussions. I talked to Dr. Wagner, to Anita Wood, and Dr. Liu up in North Las Vegas and have asked them to help me look for a better place. We have volunteered to come into their city building to do immunizations, which is primarily what we do at the North Las Vegas. In fact, it's all that we do clinically at the North Las Vegas Clinic. We are also in the process through Bonnie's program to talk to Richard Steele, the boxing club, to come in and do some immunizations up there too. But we can't continue to afford clinics like that. The lease is up this year, so we're planning on not renewing that lease, but looking at alternatives. Excuse me again. The city did give me two properties that I gave to Andy, and he should have given to Sean, who you met earlier today, to start looking at alternatives. So we will be looking at alternatives. My plan is to no longer do significant numbers of years of leases. We still have East Las Vegas, which is a good site for us, and I believe our lease isn't up until 2021. But I would rather have a lease like we've negotiated with the city of Las Vegas, which is a three-year lease with 2 one-year extensions, so that we can determine, and whoever we're renting from can determine, whether that is the best place for us. We have now opened, and I just wanted to inform you about that we're going to be looking at alternatives. The other one that we're going to be looking at, Mr. Mars, is Henderson, where we also, you know, we don't see many people down there at all, so we'll be looking at alternatives, and I'll be contacting you and your city management for alternatives there. We have talked to Turo, for example, down in Henderson about, as they start to build out their new clinical facility, they actually offered to think about having us move in there, which could be an educational opportunity for the medical students there. So we want to maintain that flexibility. And part of that flexibility, as we discussed at the retreat, is I would certainly like to work with a couple of foundations to give us some money to do a mobile van, which I have found in my history to be very significantly positive. So during back-to-school week, we could take that van out there, be off the school property or in the parking lot rather than in the schools, or we can be in the schools, but we can also go to community centers, we can go to libraries and a variety of other places to help maintain that flexibility. And again, especially during August, but we do have immunizations year-round.
Question. So you're closing the North Las Vegas Clinic again?
Yes.
And what have the numbers been?
We've been seeing about 8 to 10 patients a day.
So we either aren't doing the outreach correctly, because there's a need in North Las Vegas.
Absolutely a need.
And, you know, with us closing UMC clinics, we got to be careful about where access is. It's like voter registration. People, we don't put early voting in because they don't have a history. Well, it's because it's minorities, and we move them around on a regular basis, and they don't know where to find the site. So I think we got to be very careful about how we look at the
current.
And I remember Anita, when she was on this board, and I know Wade as well, had some real concerns about not having a presence in North Las Vegas.
That's why we're working directly with the city of North Las Vegas and Ms. Wood and Dr. Wagner to look at alternatives.
Yeah, if I can comment on that. You know, the clinic where it is right now might not be in the best location to serve the actual population that needs it. So I think closer to downtown, you know,
Kmart, probably.
The older area. Yeah, I mean, there's other Egypt areas Bridger, that so, yeah. might see better use. So I know, yes, we are working with Dr. Reiser to try to find somewhere. We need something, but maybe not right where it is.
Okay.
We are also looking, if I may, on this whole particular topic at our community health assessment and where are the needs, clearly, this part of the city and going up northeast along the I-15 corridor are the areas where we absolutely have to be. And we're starting to get some good data. Dr. Lockett may want to talk when it's his turn about some of the data that they've been putting together on premature births, on teenage pregnancy, on interception, as Bonnie phrased it, how many teens are having two babies before they get out of their teens. And those will be areas that we're clearly going to want to focus in. But that process is still in play, and that's what will give us more information. But again, we want to work with the cities as to where the best locations could be. But good news is that 333 North Rancho is open. We've got environmental health people in there. They're functioning. They're co-located with the City of Las Vegas Developmental Services Group and is doing well. The employees, when we went to visit, I don't know if I'd say are overjoyed, but they're very happy with the facility. And Ms. Rezatar could confirm that. And compared to where we're going to be, they have windows, so of course they should be very happy with that facility. We are also currently moving everyone who was in the second floor at 400 Shadow Lane to this building, and if we'd be happy to let you go up there and to take you up there and show you. But up in this corridor on the top floor has been vacant since I think we've been here, certainly since I've been here. It's now full of cubicles, and we're moving the Office of Epidemiology and the Disease Investigators over there now. And I honestly wish I had done this last year when I first thought about it, because it's going to save us about $100,000 this year. Even though we had to buy and put together the cubicles, on rent alone it will save us about $100,000 this year. And then when we get to it onto the building update, Mr. Glass will show you a layout of the building. Mr. Woodbury came 2 weeks ago to see the building, and we have a couple of other people coming this Saturday. You're all welcome to come, 9:30, be there or be square, and we're happy to show you what it looks like now. But I'll warn you in advance, watch your step, and that's why we're taking small groups through, and construction should start fairly soon on that. So I just wanted to keep you updated on that. Are there any questions about outlying clinics? And how we service them, how we hope to service them, and how we're working with our constituents in those areas. Dr. Wagner and Mr. Mars soon will be working with you to look at options for Henderson.
Doug.
The one thing, and we talked about it at the pre-briefing the other day, is I would like you to at least go out and start pricing out a mobile clinic now, you know, while we're in the process of looking for grant money or something else. Because it may turn out, depending on the cost, that by not having some of these leases, we actually cover the cost of the vehicle over the 5-year life
sure.
of the vehicle.
We did discuss that, and my response is, let's see what the 3-year projection looks like. Currently, it's not that good. It's not that bad. It's much better. But what I want to do with these lease savings is to get us to a balanced budget, and I think that we may be able to give you marginally good news, and then we can start to look at that, and we would like to work with a foundation to help us with that.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
There used to be, I don't think the Cal buses are going anymore. Are they, Mary Beth? The classroom on wheels? There may be some good facility mobile units available. I don't believe even some of the Miles for Smiles that Senator Rawson used to do is available. I think it's around, but I don't think it's being used. So there might be resources out there that maybe could be repurposed. Because it was Louise Helton that did the Cal buses. We had them all over town. It was extremely effective. But I think the money might have dried up. So there just may be something out there that people might have that have used that kind of a purpose or a service in the past.
Tim,
yeah. The also look at Nevada Cancer Institute has the Hope Coach. It's been stripped, but it was quite a nice facility. And I know that vehicle is still out there and might be an option for you.
We will look at that.
And put your name in the list for RTC, because as they retire buses, both small, medium size, some are diesel, but they also donate to nonprofits. I don't see why they couldn't look at donating to a government.
Well, they actually can donate to us. We have an IRS letter that allows that to be fully tax deductible.
Okay. They do it
IRS
on a yearly.
They're
operating right now, so
yeah.
There might be some units.
Thank you very much for the suggestions. Any other suggestions, just email me.
Thank you. All right. We will move on to number 5, which is review, discuss Nevada breastfeeding welcomed here campaign and Surgeon General's call to action to support breastfeeding.
Nevada law currently allows a woman to breastfeed basically wherever she wants to, and we support that. We do have a breastfeeding room, which I think is down that way, isn't it, Bonnie? It's right here along this horseshoe down here, and we will have a breastfeeding room in the new building as well. But a woman does have the right, the legal right, to breastfeed wherever she wants to, and we want to reemphasize that by joining with other health entities within Nevada to propose the following resolution, and I'd be happy to read it to you. Whereas the Nevada Breastfeeding Welcomed Here campaign encourages public health and businesses working collaboratively to protect, promote, and support breastfeeding. And whereas our community strives to make breastfeeding the norm for infants and children. And whereas breastfeeding is a proven strategy protecting infants and mothers from chronic and acute diseases and helps build a foundation for lifelong health. And whereas breastfeeding provides a safe, reliable, and renewable food source, especially during natural disasters and emergencies. And whereas all major medical authorities recommend that mothers breastfeed exclusively for 6 months. And whereas the Surgeon General... Excuse me. And whereas the Surgeon General's call to action to support breastfeeding calls on healthcare providers, employers, insurers, policymakers, researchers, and the community at large to support mothers in reaching breastfeeding goals, now, therefore, be it resolved that on this 22nd day of January 2015, the Southern Nevada District Board of Health does hereby welcome and encourage breastfeeding for new mothers and infants within the health district.
Question.
Yes.
I was in the legislature when we had to pass the law to allow a legislator to be able to breastfeed. And we used, there was one legislator who said it was the breast bill he'd ever voted for, but that was beside the point. We need, do we do to make sure, like, if somebody gets denied by private sector or public sector employer, who do they go to report that or raise that as an issue? Do they just deal with it internally as HR?
They can deal with internally with HR, and of course, being aware that there is a law is probably the first step towards being able to enforce that. They certainly can go to their HR department to do that. I don't believe that there's any enforcement agency, but what we would do is, if we got a complaint, we're not going to go in and inspect. That's not our job, but we turned over to the county or the city's enforcement. Building enforcement.
So how do we, just besides doing a resolution, how do people know that this is the law?
Well, we will put out a press release on this and put it on our website as well.
Are there
I don't
public
know much
service
more we can
announcements?
Do. We can work on public service
might
announcements.
Might want to also do it again in the alternative newspapers and
sure.
the minority, you know, Centennial and so
RTC,
forth.
Any of a number of places we can work on this.
This resolution is focused on the health district employment in the health district facility, or this is a community-wide?
No, it is community-wide. It just means that within the health district boundaries, which are the boundaries of the county.
Oh, it made it sound like it was just you guys.
It does sound like that, but no, it's meant to be county-wide.
Might want to wordsmith it.
Yeah. Yeah, we can do that, but we would appreciate you passing this today. We will join a coalition from Northern Nevada and other places in promoting breastfeeding.
I would move approval and ask that it within
the boundaries,
within Southern Nevada. How about just say that?
Sure.
Jurisdiction or
yeah.
something.
Yeah. Okay, so that would be my motion.
Okay.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? That motion carries. Okay, we're done with our action items and move on to board reports. Do we have anyone on the board wishing to report?
I do have a quick comment.
Yes.
I want to thank Environmental Health for finally getting something on the used mattresses, but I'm curious to know when we're going to get biohazard waste and salvage yards on the map, because those have been sitting out there for a long time.
Jackie Resitar, Director of Environmental Health. Doug, we are working on that. Staffing is an issue. We're beefing up Brian's section as well. But that is a priority, and it's on my agenda.
How short are you on staffing, if you don't mind me asking, for compliance?
For compliance as far as?
Brian's people.
Brian's people, we're on it. We're hiring and filling that position as we speak. So we're full now.
That became a priority over the last month or so, and Jackie and I have been working with HR. to fill those positions. They'll be trained and then transferred to that area. Also, if I may, we are working on the model food code and we're working on the model pool code as well.
Yes.
So that we'll be bringing those to you within the next 6 months, 8 months.
June.
Yeah.
Have you conducted any public hearings on those?
No, we're not ready to go forward with public hearings yet.
Please let us know when that.
We will. We will.
We did have public hearings on auto salvage, though, last year.
We're planning the public hearing for the aquatic food code or aquatic health code for April, and then May for the food code.
Can I ask a dumb question? Does aquatic mean the pools, the public swimming pools?
Pools.
Did we ever resolve that issue with the drain and it wasn't available and then people got it? And remember all that about 4 years ago?
The drain covers?
Drain codes and all that part of
you'd
it.
You'd ask for policy review.
Since I wasn't here 4 years ago, I will certainly look into that and see where we're at.
Yeah, it was the federal law that passed, and they had a certain time, and then it wasn't available, and we were citing people. They couldn't order it, and so, and then I think we got everything worked out, but we haven't heard back. So maybe you could take
a look. Yeah, I'll do a follow-up for you.
Okay. Yeah, I do believe that we worked that out, and certainly our model food code will be based on CDC's model pool. Model pool code will be based on CDC's model.
It's gotta go well. They got
model
they
pool
code.
Really confused for a second.
The prime regulator for that was CPSC, I think, and it was incorporated into the code here for Southern Nevada Health District for pools as well.
Right.
CPSC and a lot of that was doing the inspections.
Right. And a lot of that is, as you know, is the drains and children and adults perhaps, but children getting trapped in drains. The Virginia Graham Bell?
The Virginia
Baker.
Yeah.
Baker.
Yeah, Virginia Graham.
Okay, we will move to the health officer and staff reports and turn it over to Dr. Iser for CHO comments.
Certainly you have my report and you can ask questions about that, but there are a couple of things I'd like to emphasize. The first of which is yesterday we filled out the online application and pressed the button to begin our accreditation process. We have some pictures. I think Jay is gone. Corey from PIO's office took some pictures. We'd be happy to show you. We had a little bit of a ceremony here. So we're excited about that. That gives us 12 months to fulfill our requirements. Our next step is to do what we've said in the past, the community health assessment, the community health improvement plan, and a strategic plan based on those two pieces. Those will take some months to complete. They're not easy to do. And especially in a jurisdiction this side to bring in community partners. We have a wide variety of people on our, what's the name of it, Andy? The
A-team.
Not the A-team, but the advisory.
The community health assessment steering team.
Community health assessment steering team, including Sean Gerstenberger, John Packham, those of you who may know him, and we have a variety of other organizations, including hospitals and not-for-profits on that board that will be working with us since at least two of our hospitals, UMC and the St. Rose Systems, also have to do a community health assessment. So we're working together to do that. So I'm very pleased to report to you. It's been a long time coming, and we're now on our way, and thank you for approving that one position, Demetria Patton, who we hired as our accreditation coordinator for this fiscal year, who's done really a bang-up job in getting us this far and is leading us through all of these efforts with various teams throughout the district's quality assurance team, an A team that looks at quality assurance and other issues.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Can I ask, do we coordinate with the other organizations that are doing community assessments?
Yeah, United Way is
United
one of
United Way is doing one. And
they're on
then,
this, team, this okay. Group with us.
It just seems like everybody's sort of doing one, and you want to make sure it's comprehensive rather
right.
than piecemeal in the long run.
Right.
Okay, thank you.
And I mentioned to you some of the reports that Dr. Lockett's group has been coming up with. And again, you're going to see maps that look very similar from one disease state to another disease state to pregnancy, teen pregnancy, and so on, with this central core going up the I-15 corridor, not all the way, but past North Las Vegas to Mesquite, where a lot of our intervention efforts are going to have to take place to improve the health status of people who live within the district. There are a couple of other things that I don't know if they're good or bad news, but you probably saw in the media that we had a conversation with our hospitals and our EMS providers about the internal disasters that have been going on. That's a phrase. It sounds like what it should be, that a true disaster has prevented an emergency department or a hospital from taking in new patients into their emergency department. But it's the phrase that we use that basically means bypass. bypass dispatch. So the big problems that affects us as the regulators of the system are at least twofold. One is that the emergency departments are getting too full for other patients to come in. So when I have the big one, I don't want to have to go two or three hospitals away to be able to get care, and I don't think any person in this county wants to do that. And then for those organizations where fire service does a lot of the carrying of patients, that they may have to go outside of their jurisdiction to drop off patients, and that becomes a problem then for the fire services in particular. So we did have that conference call after having a week ago last Monday, having had seven hospitals on internal disaster. Most of those resolved overnight. Then on Tuesday, we started to see those building back up again towards the end of the day when doctors' offices start to close, when people start to get off work. And so that's when we had the conference call, and we found out that it's not L2K primarily as an issue this time, and what it is, though, is influenza, which will be another report I'll give to you in just a second. And from the hospitals, what we heard is that they're full of people with influenza and people who likely need to be hospitalized with influenza, but no beds available. So what happens overnight is that many patients are considered for discharge who are already inpatients, and then the emergency departments can move the patients from the emergency department up into beds. But it's an ongoing cycle as long as we're going to be in this particular influenza season, which is more like I'll segue into that in just a second. So what we've asked the hospitals to do is to really consider if they really need to be on internal disaster. We had this same conference call about the L2K issue last March, and that was able to be resolved, and we were able to get patients into their closest hospital. This was not an issue, however, related to EMS ambulances bringing patients in. It's people walking in or driving themselves in, or a loved one driving themselves in. And we didn't see a significant uptick in the number of EMS transports. So the EMS system would be impacted, as I mentioned earlier. The next day, we were down to maybe one at the same time, and over the last several days, we've been monitoring it, and one or two hospitals have been on internal disaster over the last several days, and that's something that we'll continue to monitor and try to work with. In our press release and in my statements to the public, I ask people with influenza-like symptoms to, first of all, contact their doctor before they go to the emergency department, and then go to an urgent care before, since the emergency departments are so impacted by the numbers of patients, they may get better care, quicker care by going to an urgent care center. And so we're not sure which of those measures are requested of the hospitals. Our public statements and all the interviews that we did had an impact, but they seem to have had an impact. If you have any questions on that, if you don't, I'll segue into influenza. So as of yesterday afternoon, we were reporting three infant deaths and two adult deaths, and I'll have to look back at Dr. Lockett, and I think we're up to four infant deaths and seven total deaths.
Six-year-old girl this morning.
So we will continue to update those numbers, but when we give those numbers out to the media, that's at a point in time. I know you all recognize that. We did have a couple of interviews yesterday. We got an update, so Jennifer and her staff would send out corrections after I did those interviews to make sure that it doesn't look like we're withholding information from the public. We still will not identify male, female. We will identify broad age ranges to protect the confidentiality of the patient. We still think that, at least at this point, this looks like an average influenza season. It may end up being a little bit worse than average at this point of time last year and the year before, which were low influenza season. Low influenza rates, that we have far more deaths and far more hospitalizations than then. But it's difficult to predict how that will go. We are still encouraging, and we would encourage all of you to get your influenza shot if you haven't. It's not as effective against H3N2, which is the primary influenza virus that's circulating right now. It's good for three different influenzas, and oftentimes we'll see a bimodal distribution. We'll see one influenza virus be the predominant one during the early part of the season, kind of a drop-off, and then a second influenza virus. And so we certainly hope that the current vaccine is good for that second virus.
Along that line, and maybe you're going to speak about it anyway, is the measles outbreak in Southern California of any particular concern yet for us?
That's on my list to talk to you. We have not had a case until, I believe, yesterday when we got notified of our first case of measles. We are working with the affected school, and there should be a notice going out today that will tell the school to exclude all children who are not fully immunized until they are either immunized or I think it's 21 days, which is the incubation period for measles. But so far we've only had one case. We are fortunate in that in the school age children, we do have that hammer of excluding them from school, which surrounding states like California cannot use. The final update is on TB. I'm sure you've seen that we have another high school TB case. We're right in the midst of doing the first set of testing for about 180 students, faculty, and staff at that school. Again, we never identify whether it's a student, faculty, or staff for confidentiality reasons, but we do notify parents of students who may have been exposed, and certainly faculty and staff. And as usual, in about 6 weeks, we will do a secondary follow-up. I know the clinicians know this, but what we want to see, what's important to us is anyone who is negative now and who switches to become positive, meaning they have been exposed to tuberculosis, those are the highest risk people to progress to active tuberculosis. The one case that we do have is active, but her smears, her or his smears, are negative or and have been negative, which means it's not very infectious. So I think that we're lucky in this particular case. That means it's as many people, if the smears were positive on this young man, young woman, adult man, or adult woman, if the smears were positive, we would be far worried and would be more aggressively, although it's hard to say that we could be more aggressive in following up. So we will follow up. We'll follow up the people who missed this first set of testing, and we'll follow up in 6 weeks with all of them. That's just our usual routine. I'll look to my clinicians to see if, in particular, you have any questions, but that would be on behalf of the rest of the board who may benefit from something I didn't say.
Okay. The next item is the building update.
Mr. Glass.
Good morning, board. This morning I have two exhibits that I'd like to present to you. The first is the design and construction schedule that you'll see on the screens. And with the design and construction schedule, as you know, we've been working diligently over the course of the past year to actually secure a building, which we finally were able to do in the third week of December. During the course of our search and prior to the actual finalization of the purchase of the building, we were in process of beginning our design construction. We had gone through an analysis of the services, the functions, the number of staff that we have, the number of conference rooms, and the entire gamut of services and programs that we offer, so that we knew what it was that we were going to have to move into a new building, and along with that, the space resources that would command within a building. So that as you look at the plan that we have in front of you, the design schedule, the programming and blocking was actually going on much prior to October. We've gone through field verification of the building, as we discussed that with you at previous board meetings, so that you knew that in looking at the building at 278 Decatur, the former Target building, that building was going to be able to meet our needs. We've gone through that, and that is complete at this point. In addition, we were able to put together a construction manager at risk and selection process for going through advertising for a construction manager at risk. We've released those documents. We had our meetings with those who responded. We actually sent it out to 21 different firms within the community. We also advertised that. We had a response of about 14 at our pre bid conference with a tour of the building, and we will be making a decision as those bids are received in early February. In addition to that, we have been going through schematic design, and I refer to the schematic design that we have back in back of me, color-coded for the four different divisions that we have in the building. If you haven't had a chance to look at that when you first came in, I invite you to please look at that. It's color-coded. The legend is in the upper right-hand corner so that you can see what division is in one, what particular area of the building. The construction documents are actually in the process of being begun. We've met with the city with their building group, the fire marshal, and others to make sure that we know exactly what the process is and how that will be flowing. We are well in process with the construction documents. As soon as those documents are completed, then we'll be taking them to the city for permitting and overlap with our bidding. The bidding on the actual documents is due in March. We'll have the award in late March, early April, construction to begin then in May, and occupancy in November, December. Any questions? Thank you very much.
So I'm finally allowing myself to be a little bit excited. You know, this was a long, hard-fought process beginning in May when we put our first bid into Target through several intermediary buyers, which we needed to have in order to change the Korea to allow us to be there as the previous Korea defined us as an obnoxious client. And we're obnoxious because we're like a veterinarian and we have clinical facility, and we're like an office building, and both of those were precluded in essence by the previous Korea. We still have one final agreement with that intermediary buyer. We've got our proposed agreement to them, and should get that done, I'm hopeful, this week. So that's not an impediment to moving forward at all.
One question. Under our current lease agreement on this building, given that timeline that was just presented, is there going to be any kind of penalties on our move out of this building?
We're at one point, Tiburti Management told us that they would continue our current lease rate on a month-to-month basis without the penalty, but the contract does call for a 25% penalty, and we've been talking to them over the last month or two about getting that paperwork signed as well. And again, just to remind you, we'll be moving completely out of 400 Shadow Lane and this building in order to occupy that building.
Thank you. I did take the tour a couple of weeks ago, and it looks nothing like that. it's a big open building, but it was fun to listen to the explanations of where everything was planned to be going. And those employees that did attend, I could see, you know, the light in their eyes. They're getting excited about the prospects of that, and it's going to take shape quickly. So it is exciting. It's a huge accomplishment for the district, and to have a home will be a great thing.
It occurs to me to add one more thing, if I can walk over to the map.
At each Target, there is a restaurant. I'm sure you, for those of you who shop at Target, you go in, it's on the left or on the right. And we're leaving that intact there. We don't have any equipment in there, but the walls are serviceable. All we have to do is clean them. The floor is serviceable, and all we have to do is clean them. So we're going to have to negotiate with the State Division of the Blind and to see whether they want to come in and manage them. If they don't, then we'll go out on a bid. But Jackie and I have been talking, along with her staff, on making sure that whoever takes over that facility hire at-risk youth so that we can train them up and get them certified in their food handler card so that they can go out and get other jobs. So that's the proposed use for that, besides having a place to get coffee in the morning and a place for lunch. And by the way...
And that would be open to the public?
Yes, yeah. So the right in here, the main doors, and this will be sort of a waiting area, and the cafeteria will be right there. There are other meeting rooms throughout, and I'm trying to find the board. Oh, there, okay. It has chairs in there. So that's a boardroom that will have a partition that will allow us to have it for meeting rooms during regular working hours and even after hours, a larger one, a smaller one, and then a smaller one off there. It is big enough to house the 100 of you that sit on my board.
Thank you. Next is the budget update.
Good morning again. Sharon McCoy Huber, Financial Services Manager. What we shared with leadership and management staff was a budget timeline calendar. And as you can see, we've already begun our budget process because we have a very short time frame, which is kind of new to me. Usually I'm used to about 5-6 months to prepare a budget. But because we have to have our budget to the county prior to April 1st, that really tightens our timeline down. So currently everybody's turned in their staffing sheets and their staffing requests, which were due to us by January 9th. Their plan sheets are supposed to be completed by Monday. Then we're going to start compiling all the numbers together, scrubbing those numbers, meeting with management and leadership as well as the program leaders to review the budgets. Our plan is to meet with the Finance Committee on March 19th to review the budget and then take it to the board on March the 23rd to deliver to the county prior to April 1st. And so if there's any questions.
Through your budget.
Oh, the plan is that we will be bringing next month the three-year projection for the budget, as well as we're going to try and do a quarterly financial update.
Thank you. Any questions or comments? All right, we'll look forward to that. Thank you.
Thank you.
And then the last item there is the legislative agenda.
After I had a meeting with that Southern Nevada Governance Committee, I'm going to guess about 6 months ago, I came to you and told you that there were possibly four BDRs related to how we're organized and what we look like that might come forward from them to the legislature. Currently, there are two that we know about, one from Senator Roberson, the other one from Assemblyman Thompson. Mr. Roberson's BDR would eliminate all appointed members of our board and establish an advisory committee to the board. Personally, I disagree with that. I think it's important to have the expertise that you all bring to the decision making that we have and to be a voting member. And I believe that that's, we had told you about that for our legislative agenda. Mr. Thompson's BDR is not quite complete, so he doesn't even know when Dan Musgrove and I met with him last night, so he doesn't even know what the wording is going to be, but would establish a two-headed district, one regulatory head and one public health head. We met with him last night and discussed with him the fact that environmental health is public health. I would hope that none of you would disagree with that. But environmental health is public health. The reason for an environmental health group is to protect the public's health from foodborne illnesses, for solid waste and the issues related to that and a variety of other things. He did say that he would go back to some of the people from the governance committee and talk to them about their feelings. Bob Coyle is one of those from Republic. Another one is Virginia Valentine from the Restaurant Association.
Resort. NRA.
It's another NRA.
Right,
NRA.
There's three of them.
Yeah. To the other NRA and see what they feel. When Dan Musgrove and I met with Mr. Coyle and Ms. Valentine, they seemed to be happy with the way that we're currently functioning and going forward. And as you know, Jennifer Sizemore over there is updating the BDR list. And so she'll be, as those are published, they'll be put into that. And we're getting so close now to the legislative session that if you so choose, we'd be happy to send that out to you by email every week. Or I don't know what you did 2 years ago.
Yeah, I start sending it out more frequently.
updated, so I will have an updated list. I'll wait till Monday because sometimes they come out on Friday, so I'll send you.
There are other organizations that will be working with Carson City. The Clark County Medical Society on some of their BDRs. There's one related that they want to support related to the availability of Narcan for opioid overdoses. I suspect my doctors and my nurse on my board would agree that that's a good thing to have, so we'll likely be supporting them on that. This would prevent deaths on overdoses in particular, accidental or purposeful. There will be some others that they will propose that likely will be, try to be helpful to them on. I have a meeting with Yolanda King coming up where we would like to talk to her about some proposals as well. Probably the biggest one that we would hope that all of you would support is community paramedicine, and that's the particular one that I want to talk to Yolanda King about. And what that does is allow ambulance services to provide more services in the field and to transport someone to an alternative destination besides the emergency department.
You're going to have issues with that, so you better be talking to a few other folks other than just Yolanda.
Well, we're not proposing that, but we're going to be, but Yolanda is the person that you all have designated as the county representative. We'd be happy to talk to any of the cities about that as well. EMS is proposing this themselves. The fire services in particular are proposing this themselves. And it would be permissive, meaning that if Boulder City Fire and Rescue didn't want to do community paramedicine, they wouldn't have to. But it does require us and our EMS group to propose regulations that would allow these kinds of things and protocols that would allow treatment options. That is one of the solutions that the Governor's Task Force on mental health, behavioral health has come up with, is allowing, at least for the mental health issue, this community paramedicine concept. You may recall, or you may not know, I'm not sure, that REMSA got a CMS award 2 years ago when I was still up there to look at community paramedicine and how that may decrease costs, especially for the Medicaid and Medicare groups, and may increase quality in order to take someone to a different facility besides the emergency department. So we will try to work with whoever we need to on these and other bills.
So once some language becomes known from these BDRs, you will come back to the board with a request to have our stance, I would say, on...
If that's what you want me to, you have approved a general guideline for us. It's your choice. Do you want to have a vote on each one? There will be how many bills? 100?
Well, those that are particularly meaningful to us. That doesn't need to be every one of them. But I think it would be worthwhile to have the board have a comment or have a stance.
We certainly will have that because we're going to have the legislative update every month. And so you will have the legislative update from Jennifer, and as bills change and morph, you'll get that, and we can talk about any of those that you want to.
Good.
I'm just looking to make sure I can answer any questions if there are any.
All right. I think that concludes the health officer and staff reports. Item 8 is the informational items, and you have those before you, so we'll move to the last item, which is our final public comment. Anyone from the public wishing to speak?
If anybody wants to sign, lives in the city and wants to sign the petition on the stadium, I have a copy.
Thank you.
Which side does the petition take?
Allows the voters to say, don't take my public tax dollars.
Without this being on public record, I'll sign it.
It's on public record. All right. Thank you, everyone. Meeting adjourned. If you have, I guess we've got somebody wishing to speak in public. I didn't see you. Sorry about that.
Good morning. Thank you for sitting back down. I appreciate it. My name is Cynthia Snodgrass, Snodgrass. I live at 1421 Lucaccini Lane. I live directly south of 1417 Lucaccini Lane, which is the home of a cat hoarder. And recently, the fourth case has been opened against this same property and property owner. And most recently, they have removed 118 cats from her home. In the past 4 years, we have trapped in excess of 30 cats and called animal control to come and take them. The reason I'm here today is because we have requested, both my husband and I, who live directly south, and the neighbor who lives directly north, we have requested from animal control and code enforcement of the city of Las Vegas to offer answers to some of our questions and to maybe give us some of the same services that they're giving to the property owner at 1417, which includes testing of our property. They have said we can't find anyone to do it. We've looked to pay for it out of our own pockets, and we can't find anyone to do it. I'm here today because at the onset of this fourth case, the Southern Nevada Health District deemed the house an unacceptable risk, and they have inspected her home in August and July of 2014. And one of the reports, according to the Las Vegas Review-Journal, one of the reports said that Southern Nevada health officials wrote that the quote, cat feces and urine have the potential to transmit illness and disease. The cats that she had in her property used our yard, back and front and side, as a litter box. We have trapped numerous cats. We've called animal control to come and get actual litters of cats delivered in our yard. And since Southern Nevada Health District inspected her property, I'm hoping that the health district can inspect my property and give me some kind of certified document or letter stating that there is no health risk, no contamination on my property, so that I will have that document if and when I want to sell the house, my house. I've lived there 25 years. I have sent letters to people at the health district and have received no reply. I sent one certified November 10th. I sent one regular mail September 10th, excuse me. It was unclaimed. I sent letters via regular mail on September 19th. No reply. I did a Freedom of Information Act request for public information. I did receive an email that said there was no information they could send me, although the RJ says that the Southern Nevada Health District has inspected my neighbor's property. I haven't received any reply at all. When I received the reply that they had no information, I sent an email reply to her reply that stated why I felt there would be documentation at Southern Nevada Health District, and I haven't received a reply. I received the reply to the FOIA request on November 18th. I replied to that letter December 1st, and again on the 1st of January, stating why I felt there should be information available to me, and I haven't received a reply at all. So I'm hoping that there's some advice or something that can be done to help me get that information, that my property is livable safely. I'm a citizen of Las Vegas, lived there for 25 years, and I think I need some help. Any suggestions?
Mr. Chair, if I might. I know we're not supposed to have a discussion, but just for information purposes, both the city, all of Southern Nevada, except for North Las Vegas, and I think they're working on, we allow for TNR, which is trap, neuter, release.
Yes.
Hoarding is a different story, and you're absolutely correct. The probably, if somebody went into the home, it was because the volume. Your home, the cats weren't inside of. There are over 250,000 feral cats in Clark, in Southern Nevada that we think we know of. So if your yard is the issue, they're going to wander no matter what. I don't believe the government would have the responsibility to go into your home to test. The reason
I don't want my home tested. I want my yard tested. I haven't been able to sit outside for 8 years because of the odor. We picked up more cat feces than you can imagine. I'm not worried about that because we picked it up. I'm worried about cat urine and cat spray. And the reason I believe that it's a government issue at this point is because we've been complaining to government officials, animal control, and code enforcement for years, absolute years. Every time we called them to pick up a cat that we trapped in our own traps because animal control didn't have any available, we purchased traps. They have, the cats might have been in her house, but she fed cats outside and drew the cats to her neighborhood.
And that's why they have to do this trap, neuter, release, because they can't just, and we arrange, we even pay for it, the spay, neuter it.
That's fine, but they bring them back to my neighborhood. And they may not be able to reproduce anymore, but they're still able to use my yard as a litter box.
Okay.
And
well, that's
been,
I just wanted for the edification, because not everybody, I've dealt with more stuff on
animals.
You
know,
it's a
the trap and release program doesn't help me.
Mr. Beers.
Mrs. Snodgrass is a resident of Ward 2 of the city, and I've been working with her on this problem for a while. It's a vexing issue. Animal hoarding is apparently one of the worst forms of obsessive compulsive disease that at least the dean of the Boston University School of Social Work has encountered. And these cats had to be put down. They were so feral. Some feral cats can be neutered and released, some cannot.
Right, cannot.
These cannot. These were not. And the city has removed the residents to temporary housing, gone in, gutted the house, attempted to make the yard sanitary after 4 months of this
they
effort?
First started working on her yard. They brought the pod to her yard end of July or early August. The pod is still in the front of the house.
6 months. The pod has her furnishings, those that they thought might be salvageable. Mm-hmm. It was recently opened, and it's not, for the most part, not salvageable. It is a terrible situation.
Yeah.
The city
had the one in North Las Vegas too.
The city is doing what it can to remediate and basically putting a lien on the home. So the city is not, city residents are advancing the money, but will be paid back. And the neighbors, neighbor on the other side of the house from the Snodgrasses is probably as bad.
Her house smells worse because of the floor plan of the houses and the layout. Her house actually smells
And so
worse.
What we do about the neighbors to this environmental disaster is a very difficult problem. And
does End Up have anything?
And, you know, I've told both the neighbors that, you know, the city can come in and do things, but they put a lien on your house. It's not free.
Mm-hmm.
So they've endeavored to see if they can find the services themselves to give them assurance that their property is habitable. And the environmental testing companies that you've talked to have basically said, we won't do it because of the potential liability.
And my house, I've lived there for 25 years. That's my investment.
I know.
For my retirement. We want to downsize. I don't think my house is at the current value of, you know, comparable neighborhoods because of the smell and the idea that this woman is going to be moved back into her house. And when we have asked code enforcement, when she moves in, are there going to be any restrictions on her? And they've said no. They've also said that they can't enter her property if she doesn't allow them to. The smell is horrendous. There's probable cause there.
Yeah, but legislatively, and Bob would tell you this too, we don't have the legal authority, any of our animal control.
Why are the city ordinances on the books then, that you can't have more than three cats?
We have,
but there's no way to enforce it.
I think we're getting a little outside the scope of the health district meeting here. But
I would like a document stating that my property is not toxic.
And again, we can't respond to that. But I would ask you to meet with the people here at this table. If there's anything they can do, they'll direct you in the right direction.
All right. If there's nothing that anyone in the city can do, what is my recourse?
Well, again,
they tested her property.
Right.
Why can't they test my property?
She's going to pay for it.
Yeah.
I will pay for the testing. I want a document that says my house, my property is livable.
That was not the outcome of the city's testing.
Yes, I know that. I believe that I shouldn't be ignored.
Okay.
I believe I have rights, that the poor mentally disturbed woman has rights. I believe I have rights too.
All right. Thank you for your comments. I would ask you to meet with the people at this table right here afterwards. And I'm certainly willing to listen to you as well afterwards. Do we have anyone else wishing to speak from the public? Yes, please. Please state your name.
I'll be very brief. My name is Carrie Clasby. I'm the Farmers Market Manager of the Downtown Third Farmers Market, and hopefully we'll be opening perhaps another Farmers Market in Summerlin. I'm going to be working with the Health Department, God willing, to consolidate some of the fees for these farmers and for the vendors so that they can have one fee, and also so that we can do a pop-up Farmers Market. I know on Earth Day I'm trying to do a Farmers Market in front of the City Hall, which we did last year, and I've been working with Paul, and he's given me some names. So I'm just pre-warning you that I'll be coming back, hopefully, with a more reasonable fee structure. I'm a little nervous. You've all made me very nervous.
I think Commissioner Collins has also asked for that, and I think staff was working on something along those lines.
Yeah, which would be great. So I just want to introduce myself. I've really had a great time here this morning, and I appreciate all your work, I have to say. It's great to see what's going on behind the scenes. My name is Carrie Clasby. I know some of the commissioners, and I'll also be reaching out to you because we want to do something further with the Downtown Third Farmers Market for the city. So thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else wishing to speak? All right. I think then we are officially adjourned now. Thank you.